This week, an Iowan died after a severe reaction to a wasp sting. The same week, the cost of EpiPens have caused controversy. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, what we know and don't know about allergic reactions that can be fatal. The firsthand account from an Iowa woman arrested while protesting construction of the Bakken oil pipeline. Iowa counties march toward raising minimum wage. And a new music festival finds a home at Codfish Hollow Barn in Maquoketa. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week to catch up on some news that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows in the week. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about severe reactions, allergic reactions, in this case, to a wasp sting. Earlier this week, an Iowan died after he was stung by a wasp due to a severe allergic reaction. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, 30 opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline, commonly called the Bakken Oil Pipeline, were arrested on Wednesday. They were blocking entrances to a pipeline construction site in Boone County. The county sheriff's department said they were charged with the simple misdemeanor of trespassing. One of those protesters joins me now. Lahoma Simmons is a landowner near Boone. She goes by Homie. Homie, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you, Ben, for having me.
Tell us, how large was the group and what were you doing?
Well, the group was over 100 plus, and we were all gathered there to send our voices out to whoever's going to listen to stop the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. So you were with your bodies just physically standing in the entrance to block the coming and going of vehicles or whatever?
Yes.
For those who've never protested in this way and might not know what it's like to be arrested, how did it happen? How did it proceed once you were there in a group blocking the entrance? How did the arrest go on?
Well, it was really surreal. You're standing there and you're joined hands with your brothers and sisters across that line. And you're looking out, and you're seeing all the supporters. You see Dakota Access, you know, workers standing there. You see the State Patrol. You see lights. You see these big rigs, and you're looking out at the fields that are being torn up. Not even 3 miles away. I can't even really put it into words how you're there, and you feel the pain. You feel the excitement.
What did
you
see?
Nervous.
Yeah. What did you see? What expression or what did you see in the eyes of the workers, wanting to just do a day's work and earn money?
They look at us disgusted. You know, they're disgusted with us. They don't understand why we're even bothering, fighting, or standing up for ourselves and landing. You know, sending our voices out there. They're like pointing and they're laughing, thinking it's ridiculous and it's just a big joke.
Was that intimidating?
No, it was just, for me, it's not intimidating because I was just like, they're there to do a job. You know, they're getting paid to provide for their families, you know, and stuff. And I understand that point because we all do a job. So it was just looking at them and then realizing that someday down the road, when there happens to be a leak or a spill and it affects all of our water sources, then maybe then they'll realize that they were a part of that. And hopefully they can, like, forgive themselves and try to do what's best for the future. So that was where I was at. And then, like, with the, you know, with the state patrolmen there, you know, they were there, they were doing their jobs. It wasn't really intimidating at all. It was just really just, it was very powerful.
Homie, is this the first time you've ever protested and been arrested for it?
Yes. And I've never been arrested before, ever. And so this was a really good experience.
So we've done a number of programs about this over the past few months, homie, and many different reasons for people not wanting the pipeline. What are the main reasons you look to that put you out there as a protester?
2 years ago, my husband and I received a certified letter saying that our property is in route of the pipeline. The drainage tiles in that field actually drain into our pond that is an acre pond, and it's right beside our house.
Mm-hmm.
So
your
pond drains into the,
You're worried about the fact that there should there be a spill, you're not satisfied with the company's assurances that the pipeline, which runs underground, is safe.
Exactly.
The pipeline's being built. It's going through. Is there any hope of stopping it?
There is hope. There is definitely hope. If we can get it, if Standing Rock, North Dakota, can get it, if we can get it stopped there, then it doesn't come through Iowa. And that is the hope. That is the process. I just got word last night that they are going to start. There is a possibility that they're going to start digging. Boring underneath the Des Moines River this weekend to put the pipe in. And, of course, we know that we all, that's our water, that's our water source. Mm. And so we will all be greatly affected. So hopefully we can, even if they do bore under this weekend, hopefully we can get the pipe, the crude oil to stop.
Homie, we have to go. Thank you very much for describing your situation. Homie Simmons, landowner near Boone, arrested this week protesting the construction of the Bakken oil pipeline. Thank you, homie.
Thank you very much, Ben. Have a great day.
You too. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, Chester Britt, he was chairman of the Iowa State University Department of Sociology, died after a severe reaction to a wasp sting. The last Iowan who died from this cause was in 2010. According to data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, it's about 60 Americans die each year due to contact with wasps, bees, or hornets. This week, there's also been a good deal of controversy over the cost of EpiPens. These are meant to counteract severe allergic reactions. Let's take a few minutes to talk about allergic reactions and how EpiPens work. We're joined by Dr. Ben Davis, a clinical assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa. Dr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what happens in the body of a person who is severely allergic to an insect sting after being stung.
Okay, so what happens is they get exposed to the venom, and that venom gets into the bloodstream, and the immune cells then will react to the venom and cause symptoms of allergy. And in a severe reaction, this includes the inability to breathe, and that can happen because of throat swelling or the lungs closing up. Or it can also lead to a severe drop in blood pressure to the point that the blood is not getting to vital organs such as the brain, the heart, and the lungs, which I'm assuming happened in Britt's case.
So in this case, the way you're describing it as with allergies, so it's really the body overreacting, attacking itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not, I wouldn't say really attacking itself. It is attacking something foreign, and in this case, it's the venom from the wasp or the bee sting.
Why does the body react this way in a few people when, for most, it's quite painful, of course, a wasp or bee sting, but not fatal?
That's a great question, and we don't really have a good answer for that. We do know that there are certain people that are more prone to allergies in general, and we know that that could be because of family history or genetics. It can also be because of how they're exposed to, we think, infections early in life. So there's a relatively new hypothesis in both allergy and autoimmunity called the hygiene hypothesis that that postulates that as we've become more industrialized as nations and more clean as societies, that we're not being exposed to infections that we have evolved to be exposed to. And what happens is the body doesn't get educated on the infections that it should get educated on, and then sees other foreign non-dangerous things as dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And you said this is a hypothesis, so how accepted is this by the scientific community?
It's pretty well accepted. There's a lot of data to support it. So there's data that shows that if you live on a farm as opposed to a city, you're more likely or you're more likely to have protection from allergy because of the exposure to farm animals and all the infections and microbes that they bring. Other data suggests that if you are enrolled in daycare at an early age, as early as 6 months of age, you have more of a protection from allergies and autoimmunity than kids that aren't enrolled in daycare. If you're born into a family that has a lot of siblings, by the time that you're born, you're also protected from allergies because of all the infections that they bring in. And then there's some interesting data about families that migrate from third world countries to industrialized nations. And in those families, the parents of the families will have protection from allergies and autoimmunity because their immune system developed in the third world country where they were exposed to a lot of infections. Whereas the kids of those families, their immune systems developed wherever they migrated to, and they will have the same risk of allergy and autoimmunity as the country that they migrated to.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Davis, does this hold true also in the case of wasp and bee stings?
That's a great question. That really hasn't been studied, so we don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that it seems to hold true for things like asthma, allergic rhinitis, and food allergies.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about EpiPens. The cost of the EpiPen in the United States has risen recently from about $100 to more than $600. You're following this story? Do you know why they've become so expensive?
Yes. I've got a pretty good feel. So it's not the epinephrine or the medication itself. We can buy vials of this for $10 a piece, and so it's actually an extremely cheap medication. It comes down to the pharmaceutical companies pricing their epinephrine delivery device based on the supply, the demand, and the competition for the delivery device and not the medication. And so what we know has occurred, it's pretty striking. So since 2009, the company that makes the EpiPen brand, Mylan, has had a dramatic increase in their price. It's gone from about $100 in 2009 to now around $600. And because of the recent public awareness of the issue now, Mylan, the company that makes EpiPen, has responded by giving a $300 discount through their patient assist program, which people can find on the EpiPen website. And they've also are now saying that they're going to offer a similar priced generic product. So it'll be just a $300 flat fee rather than having to deal with the discount.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between the generic and the brand name coming from Mylan really is no difference other than it won't have the brand name on the product. It'll be the same medication and the same device. And up until this point, there had also been currently a generic EpiPen auto-injector on the market that was similarly priced. So it was approximately $400, and it had a $100 discount.
Mm-hmm. Who should carry an EpiPen?
So definitely people that have had a suspected severe allergic reaction, and again, this includes breathing issues, blood pressure drop, and it can even include two allergic symptoms at once, so something that a lot of people don't think about. So this could be something like having hives and a profusely runny nose when exposed to a trigger, hives and vomiting when exposed to a trigger. That would be reason to carry an EpiPen and actually give an EpiPen if you had those symptoms. Also, people that would be at high risk for a severe allergic reaction, so that would include people that have been diagnosed with food allergies, a severe reaction to an insect sting like Britt's case, and people that are on allergy shots for environmental allergies.
Okay. Dr. Ben Davis, Clinical Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Davis, thank you for those insights.
Mm-hmm. No problem. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Perhaps you heard the shocking findings of a recent study by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We reported on it a few days ago on Morning Edition. In short, the study concluded the medical profession is plagued by doctors' sexual misconduct. And these doctors, the ones who are found to have engaged in sexual misconduct with patients, are often allowed to keep practicing. Carrie Teagarden joins us, investigative reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, to talk a little bit about this and also more localized findings by this study specific to Iowa. Carrie Teagarden, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. We appreciate it.
Tell us, first of all, overall, for those perhaps who haven't heard anything about it yet, elaborate on what I mentioned of the findings.
Yes, we studied all 50 states to kind of get a really the first close look that anyone has ever really been able to take at physician sexual misconduct. And we found cases across the country. In many cases, I think our key finding was that even after physicians are disciplined, you know, that the medical regulators found that misconduct has taken place, they treat these physicians as people who have an impairment issue, and they send them off for treatment and often return them to practice. And we just felt like, given how sexual misconduct is and sexual abuse is treated elsewhere in society, that was being handled differently for the medical profession.
Mm-hmm. Define for us a little more closely what is meant by sexual conduct, the range there.
Well, the range is, it's as old as the Hippocratic Oath. Doctors are not supposed to have any sexual contact of any kind with their patients. That goes from everything from, you know, dating your patient, even something like that is prohibited. Generally, what we saw was much more severe than that when discipline took place. That's not what we're talking about in terms of these cases. We saw doctors who were literally sexually assaulting patients in exam rooms, you know, especially, you know, OBGYN cases where you think you're in there for an exam and you're being touched and assaulted. We saw numerous cases of anesthesiologists who were fondling patients who had no idea what was going on because they were under anesthesia. We saw cases of psychiatrists who, again, for them, even hugging a patient has to be is not allowed or frowned upon. And we would see them take what they knew about a patient, especially patients who had a history of maybe sexual abuse. They would use that information then to engage the patient in a sexual relationship that was never healthy for the patient in any way whatsoever.
You say your study, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, looked at all 50 states. What did you find specific to Iowa? What can you tell us?
Interesting. We did take a close look at Iowa. We found, I guess, a mixed bag in Iowa. Iowa was more forthcoming with us at their medical board when we asked them for cases. They were, I guess, we felt more transparent. In some ways, we felt like they were more proactive in trying to find cases by engaging with law enforcement in the state, and that's not always the case. So I think they were looking for reports that may not have been coming in their door automatically. But we also saw some of the same things we saw elsewhere. You know, physicians who had been found to have misconduct with multiple patients sent off for treatment, sometimes here in Atlanta, where there's a noted place that doctors often come for evaluation and treatment to try to return to practice, and then being allowed to go back. You know, in another case in Iowa that we looked at, the doctor was actually eventually arrested and put in prison. This was Dr. David Gurlis, who was from Muscatine, Iowa. And though he was finally stopped, there was very strong evidence of having a strong trail, a long trail of victims for many years, including victims who were very vulnerable. He was trading sex for drugs, apparently, were the allegations, using date rape drugs, apparently, during office exams, using even some kind of sex toys. So that was going on in the office. And so while he was eventually stopped, and we've seen this, often these allegations and incidents go back for many years before something actually happens to stop the incidents from taking place.
I wonder what the reaction has been to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's, your study in part as an investigative reporter. What has been the reaction? Do you get the feeling from the reaction, for instance, that anybody disagrees that reform is necessary in this case?
We've heard very little, you know, in terms of kind of negative reaction. We've heard from many, many victims who said, thanked us, frankly, for reporting this, you know, whose abuse by a physician maybe happened decades ago, and they'd never spoken to it with anyone, and it definitely didn't report it. And so I think they felt very relieved by that. The difficulty is, Ben, that, you know, the regulation of the medical doctors is generally at the state level. So it's not like something that can be addressed with a bill in Congress. We're finding that when you ask the question about, you know, reform, what should happen or will things happen, it has to happen kind of in every single state because the medical boards that, again, handle physician discipline are located in every state. So we're continuing with our series and reaching out to regulators to see what they think should happen. Now that we've kind of presented an issue that not a lot of people knew about, and part of the reason a lot of people didn't know much about it, including some regulators, is that a lot of these cases are hidden. We'd found hundreds and thousands of them across the country, but a lot of them are handled in private with private orders, hospitals that never report, you know, police departments that never act on a charge. And I think one of the things we're able to do is expose the extent of the problem that is known and the fact that a lot of it at this point is unknowable because it's, again, swept under the rug to a certain degree.
Unknowable, but we do know it's a small minority of doctors who would do this. Would that be a good characterization?
Well, the estimates are about 6%.
6%.
So,
okay.
Yes, that's a small minority.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute or so. Carrie, end with some advice. Based on your findings, what advice would you give to patients, to parents of kids who are patients?
Yes. I think that doctors have told us that if a doctor is doing an intimate exam on you, then especially if it's a doctor of the opposite sex, there should be a chaperone in the room. That's considered the best practice. Another person, another party in the room.
Again, and it's okay to request that, too.
Well, and also most doctors should just be doing it. In Georgia, it's required. In other states, it's required, some not. But I think to request it, for sure. And a doctor should also be kind of walking through with you, here's what I'm doing and why. You shouldn't have any question. We've seen in numerous cases patients come out confused, like, was that supposed to happen? And a doctor should be very much explaining to you, especially when it's an intimate exam, what's
okay.
happening and why.
Carrie Teagarden, thank you for joining us, investigative reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We appreciate your time on this very important study. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you, Ben, and we appreciate it. Take care.
Coming up on our second half of our News Buzz, Iowa counties marching toward raising the minimum wage. I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg about that. Also, a new music festival finds a home at Codfish Hollow Barn in Maquoketa. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll continue in just a moment after this short break. And we're back midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The college football season opens this weekend. And, of course, for many, football weekends mean partying, heavy drinking. For the first time in half a decade, the University of Iowa has fallen out of the top five on the Princeton Review's annual ranking of U.S. party schools. Its publication's 2017 rankings were made public this week. The UI came in, not falling much out of that top five into the sixth position. It was the best or the worst, you might say, by it was bested or worsted, you might say, by a couple of the Big Ten peers. The University of Wisconsin came in at number one this year. University of Illinois, number three. Joining me now, Tom Rocklin. He's vice president for student life at the University of Iowa. Tom Rocklin, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
We felt we had to have you back since we've had you when the University of Iowa has been number one and number two. I wonder if you think the fall in the University of Iowa's ranking, according to the Princeton Review, is due to your efforts, your team's efforts, the persistent efforts to curb dangerous drinking in Iowa City and the area.
I'm very pleased with the progress we've been making on this issue. But I have to tell you, when I was here before, when we were number one or number two, I told you that I didn't trust the Princeton Review ratings very much, and I still don't trust them very much. You know, they administer a survey to a group of students. They won't tell us how many or how they found those students. And they ask a variety of questions about students' perceptions of what's going on campus. And then they combine those with some kind of weights that we don't know about to come up with their rankings. So we trust the data we collect a whole lot more than the ratings that Princeton Review puts out.
Mm-hmm. For instance, from the National College Health Assessment Survey, that is some data that you trust more.
That's correct. Every spring, right after spring break, we administer a survey to a representative sample of our students. It's a well-developed survey. It's a national survey that many schools use. We've been doing this for years, and we're able to track a whole lot of progress since our first alcohol harm reduction plan in 2009.
Specifically, what kind of data is encouraging to you?
So, you know, one of the things that we always look at is high-risk drinking. How many students have had more than five or more drinks in a single sitting during the 2 weeks before the survey? And when we started at our alcohol plan, that was 70.3% of our students. That was tremendously alarming. In 2016, when we administered, that had dropped down to 50.9%. which I'll say is deeply concerning, but much better.
Mm-hmm. In the right direction.
That's right.
What do you think? Do you think some of the actions you and the rest of the UI administration have taken are responsible for this?
Well, you know, I'm a social scientist by training. It's always hard to prove cause and effect in these things. But yes, I do. We've made a lot of efforts, some in partnership with the city. I don't think we can overlook the fact that the city passed an ordinance setting the minimum bar entry age to the minimum legal drinking age. That went into effect in 2010, and I think that's contributed. But there are a lot of other things that we've done on campus and with our partners that I think have made a big difference.
Are there other data points you look at besides binge drinking that fit into this picture?
There are. There are two other key numbers that we look at every year to see what kind of progress we're making. One is the percent of students that had a drink on 10 or more days in the month preceding the survey. So those are people who drink frequently. That number was 36.4% in 2009, and it's dropped to 23.2%. And the other number we look at is the average number of drinks per drinking occasion. That's dropped from 7.43 in 2009 to 5.3 in 2016. And it's worth noting both the drop and the absolute level. We'd like to see these numbers lower, but I do want to point out they're different than what most people probably think. If you asked most people around our community what percent of our students had a drink on at least 10 days per month, I doubt they'd tell you it's less than a quarter of them. I think the perception is much higher than that, and one of the things we need to do is correct that perception.
Mm-hmm. Are these downward trends, these good trends, you think in part, I mean, raising awareness about the fact that binge drinking that much alcohol is just not that good for you, or is it that there's awareness and other opportunities? People don't have to drink to socialize, for instance.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things going on. I do think there's education going on, and that actually is a national trend, that students are starting to see things a little bit differently. But I think more importantly, we've changed the environment. There are things to do besides drink in much greater numbers than there used to be. And honestly, there are fewer bars where underage students can get in and drink a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, you mentioned harm, the harm reduction plan, targeted drinking starting in 2010, I believe. The current plan charts goals for 2016 through 2019. What are those goals looking forward?
Well, you know, we set these goals actually shortly before we got the 2016 data, and we probably need to revise at least one of them. We wanted to get the high-risk drinking number. That number is at 50.9 now. We thought we'd like to try and get that to 49. So we'll set that even better. We'll aim for more than that. We'd like to get our average number of drinks per occasion down to 4, and we'd like to get the percent of students drinking in the last 10 or more days in the last month down to 20%, and we might push that one down a little bit too, given our results so far.
Mm-hmm. Tom Rockland, you've been at this for several years. I know it's worrying for all of the people in the community, personally worrying to you. I've seen you out canvassing in the downtown mm-hmm. Iowa City area, working on such things here personally. But I wonder if you would come across an administrator in another college or university with a sudden spike or a real problem in this area, what would you say? What would you say your lessons having been learned in the past few years? This works. This really doesn't work.
Yeah, I think the news there is good in a way. So when I do talk to my peers around the country, and I do presentations on this, the first thing I tell them is that there are things that work. And in fact, the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has published a review of 60 things you could try, how much they'll cost, how hard they are to do, how much they work. And there are things ranging from controlling access to education to intervention with students who have problems. So the good news is we know some things that work. And in fact, I'm confident that all it takes to make a difference on a college campus now that we know what works, is some commitment.
Okay. Tom Rockland is Vice President for Student Life at the University of Iowa, celebrating, in a way, a drop in rankings at the University of Iowa, at least according to the Princeton School, Princeton Review's annual ranking of U.S. party schools. Tom Rockland, thank you for coming in today.
It was my pleasure, Ben. I was glad to be here. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Johnson County is currently the only Iowa county with a minimum wage above the federal level, but that may change soon. This week, the Board of Supervisors in Linn County, where Cedar Rapids is located, passed an ordinance increasing the county's minimum wage by $1 an hour for each of the next 3 years. Wapello County also considering raising its minimum wage. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Bork joins me now. He's been covering the minimum wage story over the past few weeks. He joins me. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Ben. An appropriate subject for Labor Day weekend.
Absolutely, with football starting and so forth. What's behind this trend? Why are at least these three counties, I'm sure you can point to others, that are jumping on this higher minimum wage?
Well, I think you would have to say impatience. Counties, or well, agitators or activists in various areas of Iowa, included in there, legislators, are impatient with the Iowa legislature's failure to make any change in the current, as you said, $7.25 an hour Iowa minimum wage. And so that impatience now has grown to, well, we're a legislative body. Johnson County supervisors led the way a year ago this month in upping the minimum wage incrementally. And now, as you say, Johnson County is at $9.15 an hour and will go to $10.10 an hour next year. Wapello County is mirroring exactly the Johnson County ordinance.
Mm-hmm. What are the arguments you've been listening to as you've heard these local municipalities debate this for and against?
Well, the big argument for that you'll hear over and over again is the minimum wage is not a living wage. You can't live on a minimum wage. You'll hear that over and over again. Those who argue against that say, well, it was never meant to be a living wage. You aren't supposed to be able to support yourself or a family on the minimum wage. This is meant to be a guide and the floor at which all other wages are gauged from.
Mm-hmm. And the impact on the areas that are doing it? I mean, Johnson County, I guess, is our only example there. I mean, we had some dire predictions by business owners that this was going to have a harmful impact.
Well, you live in Johnson County. I haven't heard any effect in Johnson County, pro or negative. Johnson County adjusted, the wage increased. In fact, there was a little bit of contention, though, Ben, between the University of Iowa and others in Johnson County, saying because the University of Iowa, being a state operated institution, is not subject to the Johnson County ordinance. And so the University of Iowa officials said, we're going to let the market price of labor dictate what we pay those who would be at the lower end of our wage scale in university employment. That didn't go over very well, but it was not rescinded either. So the university is generally saying, we are above minimum wage anyway, and we let market forces dictate what we pay in the labor market.
Also interesting, in Johnson County, as currently the only Iowa county with a higher minimum wage above the 725 national level, is when Johnson County enacted this, Dean, some of the towns in Johnson County, north of Iowa City, I think Swisher, one of them, opted out. Right? And so has that been a concern when these other counties say, well, we want to raise our minimum wage as well?
It certainly is, because in Linn County, which is, as you said, has passed the first of three readings, increasing the minimum wage there by $1 an hour in each of the next 3 years, that had to be coordinated very, very closely with Cedar Rapids dominates Linn County. And so Cedar Rapids Mayor Ron Corbett had been on the advisory committee to the Linn County Board of Supervisors, and he had pushed through a $1.25 increase recommendation. The Linn County supervisors rejected that tacitly and went about then setting up some public hearings and went about enacting what you see this week, a $1 an hour increase over the next 3 years. Well, how is that going to go over in Cedar Rapids? Well, they have met with Cedar Rapids Council, Hiawatha Council, Marion Council. Those are the three major municipalities in Linn County. And we'll wait to see how that goes over. But as you say, those municipalities also have legislative ability. They can pass an ordinance, and Cedar Rapids could say, we want to stay at 725. So they would enact 725 as the minimum wage in Cedar Rapids. Linn County would not like to see that happen, of course, because that would really create chaos within the county.
I'm wondering, has enforcement of this higher minimum wage been discussed in any of these debates?
Well, that's curious. Enforcement really hasn't come up, hasn't been a problem in Johnson County. But in Linn County, Joel Miller, who has a contentious relationship, even though he is a Democrat and the Linn County Board of Supervisors dominated by Democrats, but he's been a thorn in the side on various issues by the Linn County Board of Supervisors over the years. And at the hearing on Monday at which they passed the minimum wage ordinance for the first time, Joel Miller spoke to the supervisors, chiding them on not having any enforcement. In fact, I talked with him later, and let's listen to what he said about that.
Well, there's a penalty for violating the ordinance, which is a county infraction, which is often what we put into county ordinances, but it doesn't specify who is going to be designated to investigate the complaints. It appears that it's going to be a complaints-based system like Johnson County, which relies upon employees to do that. And my contention is that employees are going to want to complain, but they're not going to want to get fired. And it's not going to be hard to figure out who complained about not getting minimum wage. And it's likely that those employees could be intimidated or fired, so they won't complain. So you need a hotline, a whistleblower line, whatever, a hero's line for employees to basically complain about it. And then you have to have resources set aside in the county to go investigate that complaint.
Okay, interesting aspect there, Dean. I wonder, as we wrap up here in the next minute, tell us, what does this leave for the legislature? We have our legislative session, of course, starting the middle of January, so we have a number of months before that. Will we expect the legislature to to take this nudge, more than a nudge, and do something on a statewide basis?
Well, I think that goes back to a lack of enforcement here, because I don't think the counties really are worried about enforcement. They believe, and it's been said over and over again, the main purpose here is to put pressure on the Iowa legislature to do something about raising the state minimum wage. And right now they have just spots around the state of these counties, various counties, Wapello, Altamo area, Iowa City, Johnson County, Linn County, Cedar Rapids, all doing spot work. Well, it may provide a little research data for them in how the various areas of minimum wage raises goes over so that they can decide at the state level what to do. But what happens, Ben, I'm only raising this question rhetorically, Johnson County's ordinance already says 10-10 next year. I don't think the state is going to raise their minimum above 10-10 an hour, or even 2-10-10 an hour. So does the Johnson County ordinance still prevail in Johnson County above whatever the state might do?
Okay. Fascinating. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg been looking at the minimum wage movement among many counties here in Iowa. Thank you. We'll depend on you in the future, Dean, to keep us up to date. Thank you. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The first multi-day music festival, GARP it's called, at Codfish Hollow, the barn in Maquoketa, is happening next weekend, September 9th and 10th. Sean Muller, who founded Daytrotter, he's been on this program before, has been helping to organize the festival, and he joins me now to talk about the event, to preview a few of the bands that will be coming to this two-day event. Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you again. So I have to ask, what is GARP? Who is GARP?
It's a good question. You know, this is kind of a twofold thing. You know, we've been kind of kicking around the idea of a multi-day thing out there at Codfish for a while now. But a couple years ago, I started doing a birthday show for myself. It was kind of meant as a surprise 10th anniversary party for my wife. Our anniversary and my birthday are a couple days apart, and so I flew in a bunch of people that we both loved. I flew in Nathaniel Ratliff and a couple other people, and it was just kind of a fun thing. I did it again last year, and people really liked it. We kind of kept everything a mystery and had a lot of people come out, and it was just a lot of fun. And this year I kind of wanted to make my birthday party a little bit bigger, and so we're doing this, you know, we're going to have 28 bands out at Codfish Hollow, some of the best bands and biggest bands in the world. And we're kind of celebrating the farm dog that used to live out there at Codfish Hollow. He passed away earlier this year. And so, you know, I kind of collaborated with the Codfish folks and said, hey, let's have a weekend where we just celebrate all good things. And,
okay.
So that's kind of the idea.
We have just a few minutes left. We wanted to hear at least a couple of these bands. Guided by Voice, we're going to hear a little cut from them. Before we do, tell us quickly about this band.
Yeah, Guided by Voice is they're kind of a legendary rock and roll band in America. They're from Ohio and, you know, kind of one of the founding fathers of garage rock in the, you know, 90s. Just kind of one of the, you know, one of the coolest bands that you could ever want to play in a barn.
Okay, Guided by Voices. Let's hear a little snippet of a work of Glad Girls. This is one of their pieces.
Hey, Glad Girls, I only want to get you high.
So, Sean, I think I'm surfing in California when I hear that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of, right?
Right. Not a lot of power there. Lie by Lolo, another act. Quickly, tell us about them.
You know, Lolo, I think she's going to have a huge year. Her record comes out next weekend, and, you know, I think she's better than anything you hear on the radio right now. So I kind of am expecting her to be kind of a breakout star, you know, in America over this next year.
Okay, let's hear a few seconds of her.
I don't want to have to lie.
Whoa,
know, Sean, I could listen to that voice for more than a few seconds. Sorry, we only have a few seconds. That's so good. Hey, we're going to play a little bit by Steve Gunn, one of the other featured artists at this new music festival on the way out. But before we go out with that, tell us, how do people find out more about this new two-day music festival, GARP?
Yeah, you know, tickets are available at Codfish Hollow. barnstormers.com, and we're announcing today that we're adjusting the price a little bit because we want as many people to come as possible, and so we have kind of some new pricing, and we also introduced a grounds ticket that allows you on the grounds for a reduced rate and access to the second stage that we have, and as well to kind of being able to hear everything on the hillside there at the Codfish.
Excellent. Sean Muller, thanks for telling us about the new music festival to be held at Codfish Hollow Barn in Maquoketa. Let's go out with a little Steve Gunn. Sean, thanks for telling us about this new deal.
You bet. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, we're going to go out with Steve Gunn, Wildwood, the title of this. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, Also, our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. On into the weekend, Labor Day weekend. Have a great time. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. It's how we